Good day, everyone, and welcome to Kimco's second quarter earnings conference call. Today's event is being recorded. As a reminder, all lines are muted to prevent background noise. After the speaker remarks, there will be a formal question and answer session. If you would like to pose a question, please press star one on your telephone keypad. At this time, it is my pleasure to introduce your speaker, Mr. Dave Bujnicki. Please go ahead, sir.
Thanks, Felicia. Thank you all for joining the second quarter of 2011 Kimco earnings call. With me on the call this morning are Milton Cooper, Executive Chairman, Dave Henry, President and Chief Executive Officer, Mike Papagallo, Chief Operating Officer, Glenn Cohen, Chief Financial Officer, as well as other key executives who will be available to address questions at the conclusion of our prepared remarks. As a reminder, statements made during the course of this call represent the company and management's hopes, intentions, beliefs, expectations or projections of the future, which are forward-looking statements. It is important to note that the company's actual results could differ materially from those projected in such forward-looking statements. Information concerning factors that could cause actual results to differ materially from those forward-looking statements is contained in the company's SEC filings. During this presentation, management may make reference to certain non-GAAP financial measures that we believe help investors better understand Kimco's operating results. Examples include, but are not limited to, funds from operations and net operating income. Reconciliations of these non-GAAP financial measures are available on our website. Finally, during the Q&A portion of the call, we request that you respect the limit of one question so that all of our callers have an opportunity to speak with management. Feel free to return to the queue if you have additional questions, and if we have time at the end of the call, we will address your questions. With that, I now turn the call over to Dave Henry.
Good morning. And thanks for calling in today. While worrisome clouds remain in the U.S. and around the world, ranging from the European debt crisis to continued U.S. challenges in housing, employment, and deficit spending, the U.S. economic recovery continues its positive momentum, and the retail industry is once again expanding. A recent RBC analysis is particularly encouraging as it notes that its research base of 2,200 retailers plan a total of approximately 73,000 new store openings over the next 24 months. This is expected to translate into increases in effective rents, occupancy, and leasing spreads in our industry. At Kimco, we are very pleased with our second quarter results, and we believe that they represent solid and steady progress on our key 2011 objectives. Increasing occupancy to just under 93%, same-store NOI growth exceeding 3%, and positive leasing spreads of 2.1%, all combined to show very solid second quarter portfolio vital signs. Mike and Glenn will provide further details, but overall, we are confident and optimistic about the balance of the year and our full-year operating results. Permit us to take one final bow for completing the sale of the Vlad bond at a price exceeding our basis. That done, we are turning our full attention to the disposition of the InTown portfolio, as InTown represents the last major piece of our non-retail portfolio. While no bidder achieved the minimum pricing level established by the joint venture partnership in the first round of bids, three potential purchasers are still fully engaged in due diligence and are trying to reach the necessary price level. We are also encouraged because the InTown portfolio itself continues to improve dramatically in terms of RevPAR growth and EBITDA metrics. On an annualized basis, the portfolio EBITDA is now within 6% of its pre-recession high, and our annualized FFO return exceeds 20% on our equity investment. The InTown portfolio, like the rest of the extended stay industry, is experiencing substantial rate and occupancy increases. In addition to the possible sale of the InTown portfolio this year, we anticipate the sale or repayment through refinancing of an additional $75 million of non-retail investments over the balance of the year. As a result, the non-retail portfolio should finish the year at less than 4% of our total gross asset. Through property sales, refinancing, partner buyouts, and the conversion into pari passu joint ventures, the retail preferred equity portfolio has also declined from $297 million and 125 properties to $136 million and 81 properties over the past 18 months. With respect to new business, we continue to acquire high-quality retail properties in our core market in a deliberate, patient, and disciplined manner. So far this year, we have closed on seven properties totaling $165 million for both our institutional joint ventures and our own portfolio. Additionally, we currently have a firm pipeline of 10 additional property acquisitions totaling a further $190 million. Internationally, Canada is performing wonderfully with portfolio occupancy of 97%, strong currency, low mortgage rates, and continued U.S. retailer expansion into the Canadian market. Illustrating this trend, our RioCan-Kimco joint venture owns nine Zellers stores, of which eight will be converted to new Target stores, and one will become a new Walmart store. Ed Sonshine and his team did a terrific job negotiating these transactions and converting nine out of nine Zellers stores in our joint portfolio. Bravo, Ed. In Mexico, we are also benefiting from a strengthening currency and making good progress in leasing our new retail development. We even approved our first new project this year, a small development project in Mexico City, 94% pre-leased to Walmart. Despite the violent headlines, the Mexican economy is strong, with 2011 GDP growth expected to exceed 4%. The unemployment rate is 5.4%, and the country has added 400,000 new jobs so far this year. U.S. and Mexican retailers are both expanding, and leasing activity is finally increasing in small store space, which has been very soft for the past 2 years. Overall, we remain committed to our strategic goals of improving our portfolio metrics and financial results while selling in a measured way both our non-retail assets and selected non-strategic retail properties, and then using the resulting proceeds to acquire additional high-quality shopping centers in our core markets and reducing leverage over time. Now I'd like to turn it over to Glenn to discuss the details of our quarterly results, and then Mike will provide an operations overview, and Milton will then close with his perspective.
Thanks, Dave. Good morning. The positive results produced during the second quarter are a continuation of our progress toward our strategic objectives, which Dave has just articulated. As we reported last night, recurring FFO per share was $0.30 for the second quarter, compared to $0.28 last year. $0.30 level excludes $0.02, or $8 million, of non-cash impairment charges attributable to the disposition of certain non-strategic retail assets, and $0.01, or $4.6 million, of non-recurring income primarily related to the monetization of certain non-retail assets, including the Vlad convertible bond we had previously announced. Our recurring FFO, which increased 5% from last year, was fueled by positive NOI growth, up $11 million, or 7.5%, from the shopping center portfolio. About half of the growth was from acquisitions and incremental growth from our Latin America portfolio as lease-up continues, and the other half from organic growth in the U.S. portfolio, with all our regions beating our plan for the quarter. Now, although not included in FFO, we did sell three other non-strategic retail assets, which produced gains of $4.7 million. We will continue to focus on recurring FFO, which excludes both non-recurring income and non-cash impairment charges. As Dave mentioned, our key shopping center operating metrics, occupancy, same-site NOI, and leasing spreads were all positive for the quarter. Occupancy for the combined portfolio without regard to ownership percentage increased to 93.1%, up 30 basis points from last quarter and 30 basis points from a year ago. Looking just at the U.S. portfolio, occupancy reached 92.9%, up 40 basis points from last quarter and up 50 basis points from a year ago. Same site, NOI increased 3.1% from the combined portfolio, including the U.S., Canada, and Latin America. The U.S. same site growth was 2.6%, representing the fifth consecutive positive quarter for this metric. Leasing spreads were also positive, with an overall 2.1% increase from new leases, renewals, and options. Mike will provide more color about the portfolio in just a moment. Our previously stated capital recycling program has also gained momentum during the quarter, with the disposition of 11 non-strategic assets providing proceeds of $48.5 million. Those proceeds were quickly put to work with the acquisition of two wholly owned assets and one property in a joint venture. The gross acquisition cost was $75 million, subject to an aggregate debt of $43 million on two of the properties. We are currently in contract negotiations to sell 10 other non-strategic retail assets and actively marketing over 40 other properties. We remain comfortable with our target range of $150 million in non-strategic dispositions for 2011. We continue our focus on the monetization of the non-retail portfolio, which now stands at just over $600 million, and we expect several other non-retail preferred equity investments to be liquidated by the end of the year, providing an additional amount of $75 million. Our balance sheet metrics strengthened further during the quarter. We ended the quarter with net debt to recurring EBITDA at 6 times, compared to 6.3 times at the beginning of the year, a level we expected to achieve by the end of 2012. Our liquidity position is in excellent shape, with over $1.7 billion of availability on our credit facilities, and our capital plan is on track. And with less than $90 million in maturities for the balance of the year, we do not foresee the need for a public capital raising in the near term. With regard to the joint venture programs, we have been successful in refinancing the maturing debt in the various ventures. We have closed on 8 mortgages for $147 million in proceeds, and have another 4 expected to close in early August, for another $70 million, at rates ranging from 4.68% to 5.79% for 10-year money. Although spreads have widened recently, mortgage financing remains available at attractive rates from insurance companies, commercial banks, and the CMBS market. As for guidance, as we have attained recurring FFO of 59 cents per share for the first half of the year, we are comfortable reaffirming our recurring FFO guidance range of $1.17 to $1.21 per share. Again, this guidance range does not include non-cash impairments or non-recurring income. Similar to last quarter, assumptions in determining guidance include occupancy improvement of 50 basis points by year-end, same-site NOI growth of 1 to 3% from the combined portfolio, incremental contribution from the Latin America portfolio of approximately $8 million, and additional acquisition activity with dispositions in the latter half of the year. This guidance range incorporates the 3-cent impact resulting from the early repayment of the Ladd and White Rock Fund. One last point. Yesterday we declared our quarterly common dividend of 18 cents per share. We continue to have a conservative FFO payout ratio of approximately 60%. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mike.
Thanks, Glenn. Good morning. We are obviously quite pleased at the direction the shopping center portfolio is taking, as evidenced by the array of portfolio metrics reported for the quarter. The improvement in occupancy, the continuation of positive same-site NOI results, and the stabilizing leasing spreads not only reflect the shifts in shopping center fundamentals over the past year, but also the outstanding efforts of the Kimco organization. By now, the takeaways from the shopping center convention in May have all been reported and analyzed by the research and investment community. But nonetheless, it bears repeating that demand from national retailers continues and remains strong, and the absence of new supply has improved prospects for filling existing second and third generation space. The appetite to expand is most notable for the smaller format users, including franchise-based businesses and national chains such as Anna's Linens and Ulta Cosmetics, each of whom are looking to double their store count over the next few years. Yet despite this healthier environment, it seems that there are always clouds that confront retailing and in turn challenges for shopping center owners, and this period is no exception. There's no shortage of questions about the effect of online retailing on brick-and-mortar space, the trending for smaller footprints for many box retailers, the difficulty of mom and pops to access credit to form and build new business, concerns over cost inflation, and the potential impact on operating margins in the second half of the year, all overlaid by an uneven recovery, stubborn unemployment, and even scarier reminders of the people in Washington running this country. There are no silver bullets to solve these issues. To deal with the challenges, our approach is simple. Invest in and extract as much value from our core group of assets that have the greatest ability to generate stable and increasing cash flows in any environment. Find external opportunities that have similar potential and eliminate those assets that, in our judgment, have more risk than reward over the long term. In the U.S. portfolio, what I'm particularly encouraged by is the number of value creation opportunities starting to percolate from our existing property base. In addition to the projects that are active, we are seeing an increase in opportunities in the evaluation stage, as well as situations where the key anchor leases have been signed and the approval and resultant remerchandising process has begun. For example, I'm sure you've all heard us talk about the potential in our portfolio in the New York City borough of Staten Island. The redevelopment of the Richmond Avenue site with a brand new Target store and an overhaul of the rest of the center will begin construction later this year after 2.5 year planning and entitlement process. At another location in the northern part of the island, we've signed a lease with Stop and Shop for a new 55,000 square foot store, filling the existing big box vacancy in the center and absorbing the balance of the vacant space. It's a very long approval process in New York City, but the plan calls for an opening in early 2014 and will include a complete upgrade and renovation of the center. In yet another center in the southeast part of the island, a potential redevelopment of the center is on the drawing board and targeted upon the expiration of the anchor tenant's lease, an anchor paying $2.26 in rent, about 6 to 7 times below market. And I call out these three locations as the type of opportunities we're seeing in our core market. Similar projects are on the drawing board at Palm Beach Gardens in Largo, Florida, Farmingdale, New York, Columbia, Maryland, and Deptford, New Jersey. And while the redevelopment stories are the most interesting, core leasing activity and creative approaches to increase ancillary income sources are being applied across the entire portfolio. And that's where I feel our superb operating team will make a big difference. We're making investments right now in sophisticated energy management systems to reduce site operating costs, as well as pursuing revenue through programs such as the solar program, with 3 locations online and 3 others approved. Being nimble and responding to mix changes will be critical to be successful. A recent ICSE publication pointed out that only about 2/3 of shopping center space consists of pure retail use, and adding on restaurants brings that up to about 79%, leaving about 1/5 of space occupied by non-retail users. I point that out as service tenants and non-traditional use can be an important part of a successful center, and our tenant relations and portfolio review program will be increasingly focused on franchise, service, medical, and other non-traditional use to make sure all bases are covered. On the exit side of the equation, the program to dispose of non-strategic shopping centers has begun to pick up speed. In addition to the 14 properties totaling 1.2 million square feet sold through the first half of the year, as Glenn mentioned, we have another 10 under contract negotiation. And no surprise, the profile of these assets is markedly different than our strategic pool. The aggregate of assets sold and under contract since we kicked off this process last year has had a composite occupancy of 81%, an average base rent of $8.21, and demographic statistics that are anywhere from 10 to 25% less than the corresponding statistics for the strategic portfolio. While not an overnight process, I'm confident that this program has the commitment of the entire company and will demonstrably change and enhance the quality profile of the portfolio. There's still a lot of work to do, but interestingly, the opportunity to increase earnings and operating cash flow and consequently value not only comes from executing on the individual asset strategies in our core shopping center assets, but also the dislodging of low-yielding assets on the balance sheet. Both certain assets accumulated at the last market peak, as well as some of our shopping center assets still in the development cycle, primarily in Mexico, but also a few properties from the vestiges of our former merchant building business. This opportunity, either by increasing the operating yield of certain assets, as well as recycling out of unproductive assets, can be an additional source of earnings growth in the future. Milton, final comments?
Well, thanks, Mike. Well, Dave, Glenn, and Mike have covered a great deal, so I'll be very, very brief. When I reflect on the quarter, the word that comes to mind is quality. Quality of properties and quality of people. The quality of a shopping center is tied at the hip with the ability of the center to generate a sustained and growing cash flow. The historic results of our portfolio probably show a growing same-store NOI from tenants selling essential non-discretionary items or from tenants that have strong credit and occupy spaces under long-term leases. The quality of our people is a source of great pride to me. Working with our associates, we see their passion for the business. Our regional presidents are solid, energetic entrepreneurs and managers. Dave, Mike, and Glenn have been with Kimco a long time. Dave has been with us for over 11 years, and I had the opportunity to work with Dave for many years before he joined Kimco while he was at GE Capital Real Estate. Mike has been with us for approximately 14 years and Glenn for 16 years. You may know that I have been at Kimco for a somewhat longer period. So I am comfortable with the quality of our people and our portfolio, and I know it will result in growing cash flow. Growing cash flow leads to increased share value, and that is why we are here. And with that, we'd be delighted to entertain your question.
Thank you. The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Please limit yourself to one question in order to permit everyone an opportunity to participate. Once again, you may press star 1 to pose a question at this time. We'll go first.
Thanks, Felicia.
Thank you, sir. We'll go first to J.J. Haberman of Goldman Sachs.
Good morning. S.J. Haberman here, everyone. Just a question on the in-town suite portfolio. You mentioned the three potential purchasers at this point in EBITDA. That's pretty close to where it was going back in time, so I guess at the peak of the cycle. Can you give us some sense of your expectation for the second half of the year?
In terms of the EBITDA or in terms of getting the sale done?
Getting the sale done.
We remain somewhat optimistic. The first round bids, as I mentioned, did not come to that minimum price, but they weren't that far away either. So we're hoping to get one of these three bidders up to that minimum pricing level. And so we're hopeful. What is particularly encouraging, as I mentioned, though, is at the property level, it's doing better every single week, and we're, of course, immediately giving that information to these three bidders to try to get them to that price. So there's no guarantee we'll get there, but we're going to be patient about it, and in the meantime, the FFO it's throwing off is very impressive.
And how close are they at this point to your minimum level?
8-9%.
Okay, thank you.
We'll go next to Christy McElroy of UBS.
Hey, good morning, guys. Just wanted to follow up on Jay's question. To what extent, if at all, have the financing markets impacted demand for and sort of the overall sale process of the in-town portfolio? And what's your sense for how private market demand for hotel assets have changed over the last 3 to 6 months? I'm just trying to get a sense for the process and what the biggest challenges have been.
Well, taking your second question first, I think the market for hotels has picked up dramatically. People recognize it as a hard asset that you can reprice every day, and with the hint of inflation down the road, hotels have come into favor, especially when you can buy way below replacement cost. So you're seeing a lot of activity in the hotel sector. Now, it was driven, in my opinion, first by the opportunity funds rather than the hotel companies themselves, as they look to come in at low prices. But now you're seeing across the board demand. In terms of the availability of financing, that's also increased. Although I will say lenders in general are leery of hotels, and they underwrite very conservatively, and they're not going to be aggressive, and I doubt this is the place where the CMBS market is going to focus as it comes back. But there is financing available, especially for these stronger companies that are buying hotels.
What gets the bidders to sort of your minimum level? Is it an overall improvement in fundamentals or an incremental improvement in fundamentals, or is it incremental improvement in financing markets?
Probably a combination of both. What we're hoping is they look at this hockey stick trend that we're seeing at the property level, and for the first time in years, we've been able to push rate as well as occupancy. So driving that RevPAR now is proven rate demand. I'll just give you, since we've had a couple questions on in-town, I'll give you an interesting anecdote. We're seeing a pickup in demand as AT&T and Verizon spend literally billions of dollars building out their cellular network. So these construction workers that are doing this are staying at in-town suites and other extended stay facilities for months on end. And this is the type of tenant that we need to be able to drive rates. So it's encouraging.
Thank you.
We'll go next to Jeffrey Donnelly of Wells Fargo.
I guess it's for Glenn and Mike. Concerning your 2011 guidance of 1% to 3% combined portfolio, same-store NOI, I think year-to-date you're up just shy of about 2.5%. So what do you see in the horizon that would cause your full-year same-store NOI assumption to come in towards the low end of your NOI guidance?
The only reason why we dialed back, we kept that low end, is because we have the immediacy of the Borders bankruptcy and liquidation. So in the short term, that'll take a nick out of occupancy and cash flow. We are confident that with respect to the Borders locations, which prior to bankruptcy we had 16, that they will be filled in due course. The interest and activity has been quite good. We've been very pleased with the level of interest from various box units and the like. But in the short term, Jeff, it may take a little bite out of the range.
We'll go to David Wigginton of Discern.
Well, thank you. Good morning. A topic kind of seems to be gaining momentum and has come up on a recent mall conference call is the demand for space that mall operators are seeing from traditional big box retailers. I guess to the extent that this is occurring in your markets, can you maybe talk about the competition for malls for these types of tenants and what your strategy is in response to that competition? And maybe just provide us with an idea of how big of a potential threat that is to your business in the short to medium term.
Well, we have Rob Nadler, president of our central region, on the phone. And Rob, if you could just give a perspective, because your portfolio obviously has many box retailers involved, and just maybe some assessment of what you're seeing in the competitive landscape in terms of malls.
Are you guys hearing me?
Yes.
All right, terrific. David, I think what's occurring in the mall arena is the lack of development of outdoor retail, strip retail, is forcing the retailers and the boxes to be more adaptable and more flexible than they ever have been before. Now, that's playing out very well for our ability to backfill and our success in backfilling our boxes. These guys, I think, will be first to tell you that their preference is still going to be the convenience and the low cost of being outside and not attached to the mall. But I think that they're, in some instances, being forced, so to speak, to look at the mall as an expansion vehicle with the lack of new construction going on. But the cost of operating within a strip and power center format is by far the superior way for these guys to continue to look to grow. And as reported earlier, our lease up of our second generation boxes has been very very brisk over the last 12-month period. So I think it's more a function. It's probably happening more outside our core markets, more in the secondary markets than it is in the core markets, because for the most part in the core markets, the malls have held up fairly well and don't have the type of vacancy to be able to attract the big boxes.
And I would just add one perspective. There's roughly 800 malls in the United States, and depending on how you define the neighborhood and community shopping centers, there's somewhere between 50 and 100,000 the neighborhood and community centers. So it's not, even if every single mall has a demand, it's not going to change the dynamics of our industry.
Okay, thanks.
We'll go next to Craig Schmidt of Bank of America Merrill Lynch.
Good morning. I was wondering, when we think of leasing spreads, especially just your results in the second quarter, do you think they're going to improve going forward from that level, kind of hold at that level, or weaken somewhat in the second half?
Craig, I think what we have continued to see is a continued improvement, a forward march from negative territory, it's starting to get into positive territory. If you look at the new leasing spread on a
full 100% level we're at. We are positive, pro rata, it's slightly negative. But point being is we are definitely moving away from a very, very tough environment, and we're starting to see continued improvement in terms of renewal and even new leases. In quarterly reporting, there's always going to be those situations where there could be a big tick up or a big tick down because of a particular lease. And I'm sure with some of the box vacancies and Borders coming, that not every lease is going to be signed at a higher rent. But the overall trend, if you map it out from where we were in 2009 to where we are today, I think you're seeing a continued upward momentum in that trend line. I think it will continue, particularly as we get into 2012 and early 2013.
And then that's true for big boxes and inline space?
Clearly for big boxes, and I think that reflects the demand, the supply-demand imbalances that you just heard from Rob, and you've been hearing from many of the strip center operators over the past year. Small ticket leasing, we've all talked about, is still tougher, but it more and more is being isolated to certain geographic regions, the last to recover. In Kimco, we are seeing some improvement, but parts of Florida are still tough. Parts of the West Coast and Vegas are still tough. So it really is a mixed equation, but even on the small ticket leasing, I think you're starting to see rehabilitation from where we were a year and a half, 2 years ago.
Thank you.
We'll go next to Paul Morgan of Morgan Stanley.
Hi, good morning. You guys have been involved in a lot of retailer liquidations one way or the other, and I just wanted to get your thoughts maybe on kind of what we would expect from the Borders lease dispositions and whether you may expect, apart from kind of the direct exposure that you have in your portfolio, whether you may expect a period where there's a pause in the market as retailers look at the opportunities from the 250, 300 or so new full-line stores that are out there and implications for kind of the second half there.
I don't see that the additional vacant space being put on the market from the Borders bankruptcy and liquidation is going to materially change the dynamics that we're experiencing in the marketplace. Many of the same users, the same retailers that we have been talking about that are expanding and are looking for new space are viewing this as opportunities. So many of those box retailers that we gave names of during the Linens and Circuit bankruptcy are similarly looking at the Borders boxes. There's even that new contingent, I mentioned Ulta Cosmetics as an example, where they may take 10,000 to 20,000 square feet. There are some opportunities for us on single-story Borders to demise, split the premises, and put in two users. Point being is that I don't think the marketplace is going to be adversely affected or there's going to be any significant change in the dynamics because of this additional space in the Borders bankruptcy. It all still comes down to the better locations and what the relative supply and demand dynamics are in a given market.
Mike, I would just add one thing. I think there's some retailers that have been waiting for this to happen, so I think it's something that's been building up for 6 months. You've had people like Barnes & Noble do 1 year extension with us, I think, looking for an opportunity for Borders and things like that. So I think you've already had some buildup from some of these retailers waiting for this to happen, so it should be possible.
That comment came from Ray Edwards, who runs our retailer services business and is well-schooled and well-known in the bankruptcy world.
And one final comment, I think you've seen retailers that now that there are some nice locations coming available, taking another look at their expansion plans and increasing those expansion plans. Somebody like Container Corp, somebody like Container Stores is an example of a company that's going to do more this year because of the availability of these prime locations that are coming available. So we don't expect this to be a big overhang on the market.
Do you think you'll end up demising many of yours that are out there?
So far, in terms of the relative interest we've seen, no. Just a couple of examples.
Thanks.
We'll go next to Alexander Goldfarb of Sandler O'Neill.
Good morning. Just a question. With all the recent headlines about private REITs and some of the scrutiny they've been receiving on the valuation metric, just curious if you guys see an opportunity to expand more wealth management relationships like the one you have with UBS. Do you think that the transparency that the public REITs provide provides an opportunity for you to do more UBS-type ventures?
Well, it certainly highlights the attractiveness of doing a programmatic joint venture with a public REIT and an S&P 500 REIT and a blue chip REIT. So we would say yes. It certainly enhances our ability to grow the investment management business. But as a REIT, we hate to see this publicity that's happening on the private REIT side.
But do you see more wealth management, franchises seeking out partners such as yourselves?
Not an immediate demand. As we've mentioned in prior calls, the demand so far has really come from foreign pension funds and foreign insurance companies, as well as domestic institutions like that and sovereign wealth. We have not seen the private wealth people particularly. Increase of demand. It's going to take a lot to wean financial planners that are getting 7 to 8% commissions away from that private REIT model, in my opinion.
That doesn't sound surprising. Thank you.
We'll go to Rich Moore of RBC Capital Markets.
Yeah, hi, good morning, guys. My question is actually a follow-up to that question. Could you give us some color on the overall interest from partners on the equity side of things, and how that may have changed in, say, the past 6 months, and maybe who some of the most important partners are today in terms of interest in committing new joint venture capital?
Yes, the trend continues in terms of an increasing amount of interest by these life companies and pension funds in getting back into real estate. What has amazed me is how quickly all of them exited 2 years ago, and how they see the benefits of real estate being a hard asset, being a cash yielding asset that is far better as an alternative than corporate bonds or U.S. Treasuries or other things. I mean, we can provide a pretty safe 6 to 7% reasonably leveraged yield for these institutions. So we see it every day in terms of inquiries. Our challenge is finding the products, because pricing has increased to levels where it's difficult for us to justify joining some of these very frenetic bids. So we're trying to be disciplined, and we're trying to be patient, and trying to be very selective in what we buy for our own account and for our institutional partners. But the demand side is strong.
And Dave, where would you say geographically that money is coming from? I assume it's international for the most part, but what is the source, specifically or maybe broadly of where that's coming from?
Well, in our particular case, we have Canadian money, we have Israeli money, and we have German money coming through a Swedish bank, SEB. So those are three foreign sources that are active as we speak. I'm sure other REITs have other foreign sources. But if you think about it, their currency buys a lot today in terms of U.S. dollar assets. So they're looking at this as a particularly opportune time to buy U.S. Real estate, because they can get a lot for their money, and they're still buying at below replacement cost at a time when inflation may be coming back.
Great, thank you.
We'll go next to Cedric Lachance of Green Street Advisors.
Thank you. Just going back to small shop space for a little bit. Mike, could you give us some details in regards to some of the various drivers on small shops that you're observing? So when you think about demand from the mom and pops and demand from national retailers, and perhaps touching a little bit on the financing environment as well for the mom and pops.
Well, I think the point, Cedric, is that the mom and pops really have not recovered all that much. You're seeing some
very slow improvement in some areas, but really that's not where we're seeing the thrust of small store interest. If you want to say less than 10,000 or less than 5,000 square feet, however you want to play it. What we're seeing a lot of the interest is from more the national chains, the franchisees, franchisors, everything from Five Guys Burgers and the auto parts dealerships, et cetera, that are really driving some increased demand for small store available space. I don't think you're going to see a lot of mom and pop robust increase in space demand for, I think, for a period of time. That's what the point I was trying to emphasize about the improvement, some gradual improvement in small store leasing is really coming from national and regional franchise operators than it is from mom and pop.
From a rent perspective, is this changing the type of rents you're able to charge if you have more national retailers? Or are we still in an environment where it's difficult to gain pricing power on small shop rents?
It is market and property specific, but because of the relative expansion plans of these smaller users, I would not say that rents are being severely pressured in that regard. It comes down to what space you're trying to fill and the dynamics of filling small store space in a center in Las Vegas versus a center in Long Island are dramatically different. I think that's reflected not only in the occupancy levels, but also in the leasing spread level. So it is a bit of a binary situation depending on the market. That said, overall, really what I was trying to convey is on an overall basis, because of the increase in that relative interest and demand from the smaller national users, I'm somewhat optimistic that we over time can get that small ticket vacancy up.
Okay, thank you.
We'll go to Michael Mueller of J.P. Morgan.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the difference in the rent spreads on the gross basis and the pro rata basis. I think it was 2.1 or 2.7 versus minus 1. And I mean, is there something in there that's a bit of an anomaly, or is it a function of the process of getting rid of the non-strategic assets and that's going to help to close the gap, or is it something else?
Michael, it is purely a mixed calculation in terms of where leases were signed and what centers and what our respective ownership interests were. I hate to say it, but it's more math than anything else. And the reason why we wanted to provide gross levels with increasing frequency these days to give you an overall perspective of where the portfolio dynamics are going. The pro rata information is provided so you can do your math and your financial model that relates to the effect on Kimco. And that's really it. There's no hidden meaning in those two numbers.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
We'll go to Vincent Cho of Deutsche Bank.
Yes, hi guys. Wanted to touch base on the non-strategic retail sales. It sounds like you got some stuff that's in the market, and I just wanted to get your commentary on whether or not that increasing interest is translating into better pricing on those types of assets.
I would offer that that overall pricing has improved to some extent, and I think that's just a reflection to some degree of the market. And that's even starting to open up a little for less than 8 properties. That said, as we've talked about in previous calls, some of the properties that we are looking to exit are structural problems, severe vacancy, et cetera, and we're looking really and finding per-pound buyers, so you really can't apply that broad statement to these very specific issues. So in general, yes, but I think there are certain situations that are always going to be kind of outside the normal market channel.
Okay. And then just to follow up on A&P, has there been any final list that's come out of them? I thought they were supposed to make some decisions by the end of this month.
Right.
Oh, the A&P has basically got an extension until the end of the year to make decisions on what they're doing. They are striving to reorganize the company, it's really two major things I have to do. One was to get a new supply agreement done with C&S, which they have done. And the second part of it is to negotiate a new agreement with the union. And they are in the midst of doing that. And they're hopeful they'll get it done. And with that, they feel they can exit bankruptcy. But it's beyond our control. But yeah, it's still to the end of the year before that will be done.
We'll go next to Nathan Isbee of Stifel Nicolaus.
Hi, good morning. As you look at the box leases you signed over the last year or so, can you just quantify about how much of those leases and associated NOI have yet to come online? And maybe as an extension, how much will take occupancy in the second half of the year and how much will slide into 12?
I would offer Nate as a general matter, it's I'm going to guess half and half between time of signing and when lease rental income starts to flow, and that's just an estimate based on kind of the normal time in terms of turnover of space and tenant fit out before you go open for business.
Okay, and just as a quick follow-up, do you have any data in terms of small shop leases in the centers where you have recently replaced dark boxes versus the rest of the portfolio?
Could you restate the question, Nate?
We've got a big box anchor where it was previously dark. How is that helping a small shop tenant like me?
Oh, absolutely. If the question is if we're filling a dark box, is it helping small spaces? Absolutely.
Do you have any data in terms of differences between those centers where you've replaced versus those that you have not?
Not in the fingertips, no. But just in looking at the small ticket leasing, which, if you recall, at the end of the year was at 81.6, went down to 81.1, now it's back up to 81.6. A lot of the traction that we gained has actually been at those centers where there has been new openings of mid-box and junior box anchors. I don't have specific statistics, but we know that's where the chronic vacancy was for the most part anyway. So that started to pick up a little bit. But there's still plenty of room to go.
Okay, thanks.
We'll go to Quentin Velley of Citi.
Hey, good morning. Just going back to the joint ventures, I know in the quarter that Big did another joint venture asset acquisition with you, and late last year RioCan bought in the U.S. I'm just curious, could you talk about what you're sort of hearing from RioCan and Big in terms of their interest in expanding existing joint venture relationships in light of sort of where U.S. asset values have gone?
Well, two very different philosophies, and RioCan can obviously speak for themselves, but they're interested in primarily Texas and the Northeast. That these are two markets that they're focused on growing their investment in the U.S. They like those markets, and they look for either portfolios or individual transactions where they can grow that footprint. The Big Israeli public company has more national scope, and they're probably willing to have just a tad lower quality in exchange for higher yields. RioCan really is focused on very, very high quality stuff, whereas Big has been a little more flexible in terms of the quality footprint. But each of the institutional investors we have has a different profile of exactly what they're looking for. Some want leverage, some don't want leverage. Some want certain sections of the country. Some want power centers, some don't. So it's really our job to match the opportunities we have with the right institutional investor, and that's what we've been trying to do. But both of those two in particular continue to aggressively look for acquisitions in the U.S.
Okay, thank you.
We'll go to Christy McElroy of UBS.
Hi, guys. It's Ross Nussbaum here with Christy.
I have a question regarding Borders. Specifically, did you look at bidding on any of the stores? Was there any value to the leases? I remember back to the days of Kmart and Montgomery Ward, and just wondering if there was any opportunity here.
I mean, typically, you know, with Montgomery Wards and the others, there are a lot of fee-owned properties as well, and Borders is strictly leased properties. And typical Borders lease where landlords put a lot of TI allowance into, you know, their coffee shops and things like that, basically drove a pretty high rent that there's not a lot of spread. Also, what's going to happen here is, because of how the bankruptcy code works, really other than another bookstore that wants to buy this location, a landlord will have a right to say yes or no. So the other users will have some control over who takes our space. It's very narrow who can take a Borders location without having the approval of the landlord to do a deal. Unlike the other leases where there are legal use was okay, here it's very restrictive. So, right, and some are two-story properties and things like that.
So if you were looking to buy the lease, leases of Borders, you have to think of all those considerations from a purchaser's perspective and having to deal with the landlords and the restrictions thereon. So all of those factors that Ray just mentioned didn't make it economically viable to do that.
Yeah, and our history has been driven by buying fee-owned property. So if you look at our opportunistic purchases in Albertsons or Montgomery Wards, we were really dealing largely with fees.
And indeed, even a user like Books A Million withdrew their bid, looking at the complexity.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
We'll go next to J.J. Heffernan of Goldman Sachs.
I guess I should change my name. Dave, question for you on Mexico. You sounded much more optimistic, I'd say, this quarter versus what we've heard in the past. So can you give us a sense of perhaps timing to stabilize there, so achieve the 90%?
You're right. I personally am feeling better as we see some small shop leasing activity pick up. That's been the one negative we've been fighting for almost 2 years now, since Mexico is so tied to the U.S. in terms of the economy. While the Walmarts of the world continue to grow rapidly in Mexico, and I think I've mentioned several times, they open one store a day in Mexico and in many different formats. So while that's gone unabated, the small shop until recently was very slow. We have our own internal stretch targets about getting to 90%, which is probably within the next 12 months. But more formally, I'd say realistically, 18 months to 24 months away until we get to a full 90% occupancy level. And what we've been doing, you're seeing some of our official stats weaken in terms of occupancy, because under our rules, we add these newly completed properties into the basket, if you will, and these drag down the occupancy, even though our total occupancy for the whole portfolio is now, I think, Glenn, over
81%.
So the way some of us are looking at this is we look at all of our shopping centers in Mexico, and quarter by quarter, it continues to climb, and we feel good about that. And then, as I mentioned, we feel very good about the long-term prognosis for Mexico. The economy is doing quite well. Manufacturing activity is strong, related to both auto and aerospace. Oil is obviously a big plus for Mexico. Rising consumer demand, less than 1,000 shopping centers compared to 100,000 in the U.S. and so forth. So all of those stuff bode well for us over time. And the fact that every single one of our leases has a cost of living increase annually in those leases is also helping us long term as well. And we've gotten the added benefit of the currency lately.
Okay. And then just switching back to the U.S., maybe for Mike, on the space that's been vacant more than a year, where are we in that process? Has most of that been addressed at this point, or just what remains there?
In terms of releasing space that's been vacant more than a year.
Yeah, what's same store space in terms of leasing stats?
There continues to be certain boxes that have been vacant for many years. I think if you're talking about all space that's been more than vacant for more than a year being absorbed. Clearly not the case.
Thank you.
Yeah, again, if you focus on our bigger space, we're 96-97% leased.
Right.
So the bigger boxes are not the challenge for us. The challenge for us is the stuff under 5,000 square feet, and there we're in the low 80s and moving upward. And for us, we think that's great upside. So the big boxes are not the focus.
Yeah, I guess maybe, Jay, what's behind your question?
That's what I'm trying to understand. What's behind
the portion of leasing essentially that was non-same store in the most recent quarter, I guess a sense of how that's going to trend going forward, as you think about the leasing going from here going forward.
Okay. All right. So I think today's point. There's always going to be some dynamic of that continuing, that non-comparable space being leased up, but it's really going to have to be in the small ticket arena, because as Dave just indicated, you're almost at 97% on the big box.
Thank you.
We'll go next to Sameet Parikh of the ISI Group.
Hi, good morning, guys. I had just a question on pricing power in the small shop leasing. Looking at your supplemental right now, sort of, I guess, the new leases signed this quarter look like they're mostly small shops signed in the mid-15s. On your lease expiration schedule, sort of the small shop leases expiring next year are around $20 a foot. How comparable is that space, essentially? Is it apples to apples? And if that's the case, are you guys sort of that far away from where the market is of your expiring small shop leases?
It's not apples to apples. That's that's the issue, because you're just dealing with a different inventory. Because national, you're going to have different locations maturing at different times, and that'll change the mix. However, we still know that the small ticket leasing is still more pressured relative to the big box in terms of leasing spreads. And depending on the market, you could still be down 10%+ in certain areas of the country on leasing spreads for the small ticket.
Okay, and then just last question. For the remainder of the year, what's baked into your guidance for occupancy or NOI loss from Blockbuster and Borders?
The total NOI is rent is actually 0.2% of our total rents on an annual basis. So the effect is going to be really de minimis.
And we took
it out for planning purposes.
And that's Borders. What about Blockbuster?
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
We'll go next to Jeffrey Donnelly of Wells Fargo.
Just to follow up on a modeling question, I guess two parts. The marketable securities portfolio was significantly cut back in the quarter. Is that a one-way change for you guys? And I guess as a follow-up, can you talk about the interest, dividends, and other income line in the back half of the year? Because in Q2 there was a sort of a $10 million non-recurring pop, but I'm wondering if, given the light of the direction of that securities portfolio, should we expect that will be meaningfully cut back in the back half of the year?
Yeah, well, the marketable securities, the size of the portfolio is only about $40 million today. The biggest item, obviously, was the Ballad convertible note, which is gone.
Right.
And we had, obviously, in our original guidance, we weren't planning to sell that until sometime, actually having it mature back in 2013. So, as I mentioned in the guidance, we had to take that into account. But in terms of where we are, I mean, there's a small amount of securities that's left. We don't plan to grow that at all. As a matter of fact, you'll actually see it continue to decrease as we go further in the year. As another bond matures later in the year, that'll get paid off. And in terms of the interest, dividends, and other investment income, there is a little bit of a pop this quarter from the distribution received on a private equity investment where we had virtually no basis. So that's part of the non-recurring flows that we pulled out anyway. So you'll see that number come down a little bit.
Okay, no, that's helpful. Thank you.
And that does conclude today's conference call. At this time, I'll turn the conference back to our host.
Thanks, Felicia. And a final reminder, our supplemental is posted on our website at www.kimcorealty.com. Thanks for participating today.
That concludes our call. Thank you for your participation.